So in week three, actually, we talk about cognition and emotion, but more particularly, how can we or can we change emotion? And we talk about this from a variety of perspectives in our class. Today, I'd like to ask Anna, what Sufi practices influence the emotions of a practitioner, and how that happens. I think we've covered a little bit with the breath and the vibrations, but we'll invite you, Anna, to talk a little bit more about that. And thank you.
Thank you. This is a wonderful question, because this kind of sums up and synthesizes what we spoke about in week one and week two. Because when we speak about the nature of emotion and what the Sufi practices do that influence the emotions and the practitioner, we're now talking about the methodologies that the Sufi esoteric teacher gives their students. Now, usually these are never spoken about. These are under the guidance of a deep esoteric promise that when one is given these practices, one holds them dear in their heart and takes them very deeply into their own realm of practice. And they're never exchanged with anybody, only with you and the teacher you exchange these, but you do them. And only through the doing of them do you recognize the experiential values of them. So, but I can give you an idea of what they are. I cannot give you the exact ways to approach this, because I would be breaking a certain code, but I can tell you some of the ideas and how we approach these practices.
Okay.
So, and I love this, because there's a wonderful book that I came across, by the way, two books, which one of them is Adlerian Ideas, which center around behavior and its consequences, which of course you all know. And then Adler says, putting these earned insights into practice are one of the most important parts of the learning capacity. Now, Sufis have always felt this way. So in this way, Adler and the Sufis stand side by side. But a book that I'd like to recommend is called Transpersonal Communication, and it's by Weinhold and Elliott, and it's how the breath is central to centering and facilitating peak experiences. I found that book very energy. It also speaks about the levels of energy and compassion and forgiveness. And it's by Spectrum Publications, and it was in 1979. It's a little bit older than what we're seeing now, but it's a very valuable book, and the fact that it brings to the forefront what I'm going to be talking about, which comes from Sufi practice, but this codifies very much what Adler was saying about using our insight and applying our insight into practice, because if we don't do that, you know, what have we gained if we don't follow that trajectory of awareness and of application? So from a Sufi perspective, you know, truth is absolute. And truth is absolute because transcendent unity is not a disputed element of one's experience. It is because you're living it, and it is evident in the way that you're living and how you live it. So it's not a disputed element. And as you know, the principle and most important aspect of the practice we've already spoken about in week two, which was about the core of the breath and how important this is as a vital system and science in the Sufi esoteric practice. But there is one other very deep practice that correlates with this, and it's called Mujahida. Now, Mujahida is very important because it is the practice of the divine presence within one's own heart. And it is done for the purpose of controlling rampant emotions.
Interesting.
And one begins to build by doing this, by the control. Now, this is not fascistic. By the control, you are building an atmosphere of strength. And that atmosphere of strength, it's not strength matching strength. it's built, this strength comes as an elimination of weakness and shortcomings of your own nature, you see. It's not measuring strength against strength. You see the difference there? There's a slight value, a subtle value there. Mm-hmm. It's building strength so you have the wherewithal to withstand an addiction. The wherewithal to stand up against the mind that says, I'm going to say bad things about my friend in my mind. We do this in Vipassana training, you know. You watch your mind so that when you're in the middle of a dialogue or you're sitting with someone at dinner or something, you know, you sometimes have these rampant thoughts. You're having this wonderful dinner with a friend and all of a sudden you get this image in your head, you want to get up and smack them. You know, and the object of objectively seeing the mind and looking at the mind, do that. You know, we all do this. I mean, this is the hilariousness of our mental realm, of our cognitive mind, is that in mujahida, you see, you are always holding the divine presence in your heart. So you are saying, you are looking at yourself smacking the divine presence, and it halts you. It halts you immediately because you are smacking that which you idealize. So there is another way of saying this. The other way of saying it in mujahita practice is called aklak ala, or walking in the presence of your divine master, walking in the presence of your immediate divine master or teacher. That is your helpmate. See, that's your boon companion. That goes back to our last week's lecture. If your boon companion is around you, and you use your boon companion as the image in your heart, you wouldn't say such things in front of the boon companion that you wanted, you know, here you were sitting with your wife or your husband, and, you know, you were having this divine dinner, and all of a sudden this image comes in your head that you wanted to smack him or her. Now, if your teacher is right beside you, you would probably quell that and say, oh my God, you know, I would be showing that part of myself to the teacher that would be very embarrassing to me. That's an embarrassment to me. Mm-hmm. Because it's showing that that savage part of myself, or that untrained part of myself. So mujahida is really putting yourself in the Bhagavad Gita. It's a way of putting yourself in a Kurukshetra, you know, in the battlefield where Krishna and Arjuna mm-hmm. are in the battlefield, mm-hmm. and you are fighting in the battlefield of your own cognition. And that is what the great holy prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said, is the great jihad. The great jihad is the battle that we are fighting within ourselves. That is the true practice of the Sufi. So there's the practice. So it's mujahida is the true practice, and we call it, the code name of that is called aklak ala, walking in the footsteps of God, walking in the presence of God, walking beside God. So the important things to learn about mujahida is that the jihad, the great jihad is going to come. It's going to come, by the way, in nanoseconds of our consciousness. We'll be fighting this great jihad in a nanosecond of consciousness, just in the same image that I just described to you, having this blissful dinner with your mate, and here you are having this violent thought of slapping them. That is, you've just entered the field of the great jihad. Now, the job of the great warrior is to win the battle. So, mujahida is the assisted methodology that all practitioners of Sufism use, which is, I am going to win this battle, and I am not going to allow that part of myself that wants to defeat my love of my mate to intercept at any moment. So I am going to stand vigilant as a warrior on the field and be a centurion at the gate of my perception, as Ken Kesey once said, when he was talking about the LSD experience, of having a centurion at the gate of perception and not allow myself to go through the revolving door of losing the battle. I'm not going to go through that revolving door. So aklak ala is walking in the footsteps of that jihad.
Even to the point of, dream worker training is coming in here, even to the point of self-sacrifice, sacrifice, in order to transform oneself, to kill oneself, to win the battle.
I don't think it's so much a killing of oneself. It's a transiting, representing the struggle for the sphere of refining loving. So what you're doing is that you are fighting for the sphere of loving,
right,
rather than for the sphere of hatred or of separation. You are always using love as your boat to unity.
I didn't mean killing as death. I actually was in a more of a dream work perspective, thinking of that death as transformation.
Oh, I
see. Through self-transformation,
yes,
one is transforming oneself, catching oneself in that moment of wanting to slap the other in,
yes,
that jihad.
Yes, that's right.
And transforming it to away from that more base reaction.
I would assume that that would be a very workable, yes, that would,
yeah,
be the workable words for how it applies. Because ultimately, by replanting the goal of loving as your ideal for how you would like to act, you've already supplanted the goal that keeps you in otherness. You've already supplanted,
right,
it. Just by re-implementing that goal. It's like, you know, may all, in the Buddhist tradition, we always have a vow at the end of all practices, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all beings never be separated from the great bliss, which is happiness. May all beings live in equanimity, free of attachment and aversion toward near ones and far. That last line is very, very important, so that we have no attachment to have them do our will, and yet we have no attachment toward being in aversion to them either. So it's sitting in that very neutral place in which we fight the battle of our own mind. And don't forget, you know, any little light of violence that comes up in our mind can follow with an action. So that the Sufi immediately realizes that all thoughts follow action, or all such precede action, that we try to get the thought first. So our great jihad is the thought. That's in the very way that we work with cognitive emotion.
Would thoughts precede emotion? Actually, I think you've already answered this by saying that thoughts and emotion are directly connected.
Connected, yes. They're directly.
Thoughts and emotions can arise simultaneously.
Yes, they can, and they do.
And they do.
At least from my experience of it. This is I'm only speaking from one small person's experience.
Right.
So, you know, for many of us, you know, we could have a very, very different vantage point on that. But from my experience, as the struggle in the Gita with Krishna and Arjuna indicate, the struggle with the spheres of the earth and the rising of one's highest potential to meet the battle, to meet that battle, to act for the benefit of fighting that battle when the moment it arises in the cognition. Well, you see, that's a very different, that's the true mujahida, because that is coming from the heart impulse to love first, to put love first above all else. And that's quite a struggle, you know. That's quite a struggle in the human condition, and I think we're always going to be facing it on all levels of psychotherapy or psychology in general. I think that is one of the primary. It came up at our meeting today. You know, it was very interesting that love was at the very base of many of the comments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to love, how to respect, how to walk with the teacher, how to learn, how to endeavor to understand how the transpersonal can take us to this greater embrace of differences and perspectives and epistemologies which will inform us,
mm-hmm,
and move us to greater unity, collaborative unity.
This is slightly off topic, but if I could go back to the mujahida. Is that an Islamic specific concept?
It is Islamic in the sense that it came up through many of the practitioners, such as Al-Ghazali, you know, who was a jurist. You know, he wrote about the law, mm-hmm, the Sharia, and was an exquisite commentator on the Sharia. But it came earlier than that. It was the abiding principle in the great mystical traditions found in the work of Al-Hallaj and the divine writers, for instance, the poets, Omar Khayyam and Hafiz and Kahabir and Ferdowsi and these great master poets, you know, that really understood that only when the heart is moved by the presence of the divine within one, meaning it has to be totally embodied, can we get to the level of transforming and fighting the great jihad, which is what the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said is really the great battle. It has been totally abducted, this term has been abducted by Western media without really understanding the depth behind it. Mm-hmm. Because it's truly an esoteric practice that the great prophet was pointing us to.
Well, and why I was wondering is because I'm wondering, again, the dream worker in me is coming out. There are times when a person will manifest physically a spiritual process that's going on, or some spiritual principle. And I'm wondering about suicide bombers and the use of the term jihad, and if that process is actually a physical manifestation of this spiritual process we're talking about, self-transformation, which is a death type of process, through catching that cognition and emotion at that point, and it was really a self-transformative act, and this is the great jihad. The great battle, or going into the Bhagavad Gita, this is where Arjuna must make the choice to act.
Yes.
And I was just wondering about that. You know, this is where the spiritual realm having been manifest in a bizarre way. Anyway, that's what I was curious about.
Well, you know, from my understanding and what news that I have received from my connections and relatives and friends who live in the Middle East, it seems to me that this kind of type of self-sacrifice, you know, in which the person loads themselves with armaments and then goes in and blows themselves up, is really focused on those who are coming from poverty and those who don't seem to have a clear a way of moving forward in their life that would be progressively joyful. That they're suffering under some tremendous regime of oppression or illiteracy or some deep level of sorrowing that you and I will probably never have to face in our lifetime. Alhamdulillah, we don't ever have to do that. But, you know, I am so careful about my judgments about this type of action. It is so reprehensible to me on one level only, that the life is so sacrificed and given away at such young years. But the desperation behind that choice must be looked at so carefully.
Yeah.
Because recruitment for this type of activity always is focused in areas of deepest distress and poverty in the world. This is where the members of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations recruit. They recruit in the most horrific areas and pockets of poverty. So the way that I see it as a Sufi, the only way that we can address this issue is to address these pockets of deep suffering in the earth. Mm-hmm. And that is how we begin to change this model that has entered our society now, because it's always out of great despair to me that this is going on.
So I realized that was off topic. I just wanted
But you know, that's my immediate response to that is that to open up the door of compassion and awareness that where this is coming from, the recruitment of how this is being done is done due to the oversight by the communities of the world that are not looking at these great pockets of distress that are in our globe today. And we would all benefit if we would look at it. We would all benefit and do something, you know, whatever, even if it's small. You know, there's a wonderful Jewish proverb, if you help one person, you help the whole world. And that to me is a very, very important thing. You know, you can do small things, as Mother Teresa says, with great love. And they can change the world. So I don't feel that we have to feel overwhelmed or feel backed up against a wall because we don't understand the situation. I just know out of some material that has come my way and mm-hmm. information that has come my way that these recruitments are coming in areas of great distress. And so we can take a look. You know, this is a place of deep concern. If it is a place of deep concern to any member of this class, there are ways in which each one of us can help one other person in this earth, and that will change the world. That's all we need to do. Well, it's not all, but you know, it is a step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so other areas that we have.
So other areas which would be, is in the Mujahida, in walking in the footsteps of the divine, in our hearts and in our minds, there is a corollary outcome to this in Sufism, which identifies the Sufi exactly, and it's called adab, and it's called divine manner. Adab, that's what adab means. It means the divine manner, and what it means is that there is a natural courtesy of the Sufi to everything that's living, a natural courtesy, because once your companion is the divine, and the divine is with you holding your arm, there is never any blame. It is like the I Ching says, no blame. There is never blame. There is just adab. There is divine manner. There's divine courtesy to all beings and to all living things. So one then treats everything with respect, everybody with respect, no matter how disrespectful they might behave, and ultimately holds the job of Mujahida, which is that entering that battlefield, as your primary goal for being in relationship, not only with yourself, of course it's the ultimate relationship, but being in relationship with all that we see around us. That's the complement to Mujahida, is adab. And of course, it is based on there is a method that complements that, which I'm just reminded of, which is called tauba, and that tauba is repentance, which is that if we have failed ourselves and failed in our own eyes, or failed in the eyes of God, or failed in the eyes of our beloved boon companion or teacher, or guide, then please let us repent for that, meaning ask for forgiveness. Because asking for forgiveness, as we found in the, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, the AA programs, they are very important to rehabilitation. Asking those that we've hurt, you know, to forgive us. I mean, that's so tauba is the third aspect of Mujahida. So you have, in Mujahida, you have the first principle, which is walking with the divine. You have the second principle, which is adab, the ultimate courtesy to all that it lives. And then you have tauba. If there is that quality of yourself that you haven't forgiven, by all means get in there and begin the process. And there's the method. Now, I can't tell you how the method is designed for each practitioner and each myriad, each student on the path, but that is the principle of the design. And that is how that incorporates the four schools of the Sufi principles of integration.
And so
a practice influence of the emotions and cognition and physical body.
That's how the emotions are influenced.
That's right.
And so my guess would be that in the process of
Mujahida.
Mujahida.
Yeah.
Adab, and the third was Tauba, that when engaging in these practices, those will in turn have aspects of breath control, and in order to control the energy body, or to influence the energy body, to influence the emotional body, the physical body, the mental body. And that those are the practices within the method of mujjahida, adab, and tauba.
That's correct. So, you know, from a vantage point of separating them out, if I were to do this, which we don't in Sufism, we don't separate it out, but if I were just for a chance of talking about it here in our dialogue with the class, if I were to separate these out, it would be as though the emotions do not assist in this attainment of mujahida. They don't really assist, because they really just throw a certain glow on things. They throw a certain glance on things. For instance, here you are at this dinner. We're going to go to this proverbial dinner with your wife or husband, whatever, and you want to have this emotion of slapping them. Well, the emotion of slapping them is very much a shadow element of feeling, isn't it? It's a shadow. It's a kind of a rising feeling that you're having in the sense of a very joyous occasion. So that's kind of how emotions are regarded. But if the cognition sees it, you see, if the cognition sees it, then they are immediately working together. That's why, and ultimately, they're not separated in Sufi methodology that I can see. Mm-hmm. You know, there some other people might separate them out and show how they can be isolated out in view of the practices. But in the inherent view, the form of mujahida keeps them inherently integrated into the atomic system of awareness, into the atomic overview, or the unitive system of awareness of what we are as a full human being, attempting to bring through, to manifest a truly joyous life filled with all the potential of divine grace. So that's kind of the idea of the unification principles and why the Sufis don't tear them out. It's like you can't separate pollen molecules that are fertilizing all the lotus. Now the lotuses in that image in the first week of floating on the ocean of space and time are all distinct in their principles and doctrines, but the pollen, we could look at the little pollen molecules floating in the air, but they really will not reveal anything if we distinguish one pollen from another little piece of pollen.
Right.
If you follow what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
We look at the pollen as the fertilizing agent, and we look at the system, the whole system, as the fertilizing agent of a beneficent life. Now, the things that we look at the most deconstructively is the breath.
Mm-hmm.
That we will pull apart, but we don't pull apart the intrinsic harmony of the working systems of the individual. That came later in psychology. It came later.
What about, I'm curious about this, I found differences between, for example, Llewellyn von Lee's description of emotion and longing and fulfillment of longing by becoming going into union with the beloved, versus somebody like Inayat Khan, who in the writings that I read talked about emotion as being of the nafs, the lower nafs.
Mm-hmm.
And that one had to overcome emotion or get beyond emotion, because that wasn't the actual aspect of connection. It was more part of the lower self. So one, Llewellyn von Lee and even Rumi, I would think, seemed to go into union through emotion,
mm-hmm.
or maybe through higher emotion like compassion and love.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe... And yet Khan is talking about lower types of emotions. Is there a distinction between higher emotion and lower emotion? And
Well,
maybe there are different types of teachings even within Sufism about emotion and life.
Well, I think any emotion that is clinging and that moves into attachment could be seen, you know, if we're going to use this hierarchical scale of lower and higher, then I would say that they would be seen as the lower aspects or the grosser forms of emotion.
Okay.
I like to use that, gross and refined. I like those terminologies.
Less
because
higher.
Yeah. So that the higher emotions would be those that are more geared toward compassion, loving kindness, blessing, love, not romantic love, but love that
mm-hmm.
would be ultimately the divine form of loving.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jung, I remember Jung saying only the mystics bring to religion what is creative in itself, you know. And I think what is greatly creative in the Sufi mystical approach is the use of love through fana, through the effacement of the self in the divine. Now that takes a lot of love in the higher, the more refined aspects of love to understand what fana really is. And that takes some work with the teacher to move to those states of refinement, because we can have very grosser forms of loving, which is about attachment and fulfilling of one's desires and needs. That's not the kind of love we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that could be allocated, as Llewellyn said, to the lower emotion, you know, to the lower aspect of the emotional body, and can be separated out. I think you can find that in any wisdom tradition. But I'm speaking kind of in the overview of some of these four school Sufism,
yeah.
That the ideas of separating them out was not so much the propensity as much as the science of breath and the deconstruction of those methods
mm-hmm.
were more important to people who were of the advanced stages of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
That they wanted to give methods that intrinsically balanced and brought harmony to the person and peacefulness and joyfulness to the life, so that the life was celebrated as the divine life, then looking at that which broke it, deconstructed it into categories. Although you will find that as well, particularly in later Sufi writings, you can see that deconstruction taking place. But in the early Sufi mystical writings, you wouldn't see it so much. I mean, I remember this Hopi phrase is that only crazy people live through their head, you know. I think that's so funny. Because, you know, in essence, it's not to separate you cannot separate the human. The human is an intrinsic system.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that.
Well, it's part of the analysis of Western.
Right, right. And we can get very attracted and I would say fixated on the of isolating and individuating phenomena of the human, you know, of the human being,
mm-hmm.
without looking at the holistic system in which it arises. I like what Robert Romanchin said today at the lecture. I think most of you were here that's in this class or at this lecture, and you heard him say that any epistemology that separates out and stands on its own can be for the researcher a great source of violence. And I appreciate that statement. I might not be quoting him absolutely accurately, but it's close enough for jazz. So the Sufis feel the same way about cognition, emotion, and the atomic system of the body. They see that they look at some of the focused elements of the being, but their inherent principle is to that which unifies and brings it into working harmony. That is probably the exegetical trajectory of the essence of the Sufi's mystical contribution.
Something else that might come up as a question within the class, the Kalb el Kalb?
Yeah, the Kalb. The Kalbi Kalb.
Kalbi Kalb. In the West, we often think of emotion as sitting within the heart, and in some of the Sufi books I read, they also placed emotion within the heart, and that the longing and the beloved were found through the heart, and the love and union were found through the heart. What would you say to that as far as our emotions within the heart and the heart of hearts, the innermost heart, isn't necessarily a physical reality. Anyway.
Yeah, it's not so much a physical reality, but it is a reality beyond reality. As the Sufi call it, the Arsh, the throne of God. The heart is the throne of God. And it's located somewhere in the heart space. It's located somewhere there. And it can be said that it's the innermost center of the heart of the Creator itself. And if God is love, and it is this love which connects all human hearts to all other hearts, then it is there that the Spirit of Guidance speaks to all of humanity. And so when the heart is in connection, when that red phone is connected in the heart to the divine voice, as the avatars have proved that to be true, and those great individuals who have attained this state have shown that when the soul is liberated in this way and that connection is living, that the Spirit of Guidance behind every name and form of creature becomes lucid. And the diamond awareness of that lucidity is how we then move and have our being in our reality. We are no longer subverted by the opaque veil of delusion, of separation. We are now seeing through the crystal mind of clear sight of who is the mover behind all that moves, who is the speaker behind all that speaks, who is the actor behind all that acts, and so forth and so on. So it is that very subtle and refined awareness, that diamond crystal vision of seeing and being and hearing and touching, that allows the Sufi to stay ever moving forward in their connection to the whole unit system of the life itself, of the life force itself, that unified force of cognition, emotion, and atomic systems that keeps us attracted and devoted. And thus we become practitioners of these methods of Mujahida, Adab, and Tauba, because we believe that crystal state, that diamond state, is the state that we are seeing and experiencing. We get a glimpse, you know. Sometimes a glimpse is all you need to run the whole life. Just one little glimpse of that diamond clarity can change your whole life. Well, I think that's it. And
thank
I thank you all for sitting with us. Thank you, Ryan, for asking me so much to be with you today with your class. And I wish you all blessings, everyone. May you walk through that crystal door of diamond awareness.
Thank you, Anna, for gracing us with your time and wisdom. And as a lineage holder, I really appreciate what you've given us.
Thank you.
The preciousness of what you've given us.
May it bring benefit.
Yes.
Thank you. Namaste.